Hearings were held at Unoma, and while they were going on, a group of the materials scientists confronted Anne after dinner. A lot of the rest of them were there to witness this confrontation. Underhill's main dining hall filled four chambers whose dividing walls had been removed and replaced by load-bearing pillars. It was a big room filled with chairs and potted plants and the descendants of the Ares's birds, and most recently lit by windows installed high across the northern wall through which they saw the ground-level crops of the atrium. A big space, and at least half the colonists were in it eating when the meeting took place. "Why didn't you discuss this with us?" Spencer asked her. Anne's glare forced Spencer to look away. "Why should I discuss it with you?" she said, turning her gaze on Sax. "It's clear what you all think about this. We've gone over it many times before, and nothing I've said makes any difference to you. Here you sit in your little holes running your little experiments, making things like kids with a chemistry set in a basement, while the whole time an entire world sits outside your door. A world where the landforms are 100 times larger than their equivalents on Earth, and 1,000 times older, with evidence concerning the beginning of the solar system scattered all over, as well as the whole history of a planet, scarcely changed in the last 1 billion years. And you're going to wreck it all. And without ever honestly admitting what you're doing, either. Because we could live here and study the planet without changing it, we could do that with very little harm or even inconvenience to ourselves. All this talk of radiation is bullshit, and you know it. There's simply not a high enough level of it to justify this mass alteration of the environment. You want to do that because you think you can. You want to try it out and see, as if this were some big playground sandbox for you to build castles in, a big Mars jar. You find your justifications where you can, but it's bad faith, and it's not science." Her face had gone bright red during this tirade. Nadia had never seen her anywhere near as angry as this. The usual matter-of-fact facade that she placed over her bitter anger had shattered, and she was almost speechless with fury. She was shuddering. The whole room had gone deadly quiet. "It's not science, I say. It's just playing around. And for that game, you're going to wreck the historical record, destroy the polar caps and the outflow channels and the canyon bottoms, destroy a beautiful, pure landscape, and for nothing at all." The room was as still as a tableau. They were like stone statues of themselves. The ventilators hummed. People began to eye one another warily. Simon took a step toward Anne, his hand outstretched. She stopped him dead with a glance. He might as well have stepped outside in his underwear and frozen stiff. His face reddened, and he cracked his posture and sat back down. Sax Russell rose to his feet. He looked the same as ever, perhaps a bit more flushed than usual, but mild, small, blinking owlishly, his voice calm and dry, as if lecturing on some textbook point of thermodynamics or enumerating the periodic table. "The beauty of Mars exists in the human mind," he said in that dry, factual tone, and everyone stared at him amazed. "Without the human presence, it is just a collection of atoms, no different than any other random speck of matter in the universe. It's we who understand it. And we who give it meaning. All our centuries of looking up at the night sky and watching it wander through the stars, all those nights of watching it through the telescopes, looking at a tiny disk trying to see canals and the albedo changes, all those dumb sci-fi novels with their monsters and maidens and dying civilizations, and all the scientists who studied the data or got us here. That's what makes Mars beautiful, not the basalt and the oxides." He paused to look around at them all. Nadia gulped. It was strange in the extreme to hear these words come out of the mouth of Sax Russell in the same dry tone that he would use to analyze a graph. Too strange. "Now that we are here," he went on, "it isn't enough to just hide under 10 meters of soil and study the rock. That's science, yes, and needed science, too. But science is more than that. Science is part of a larger human enterprise, and that enterprise includes going to the stars, adapting to other planets, adapting them to us. Science is creation. The lack of life here, and the lack of any finding in 50 years of the SETI program, indicates that life is rare, and intelligent life even rarer. And yet the whole meaning of the universe, its beauty, is contained in the consciousness of intelligent life. We are the consciousness of the universe, and our job is to spread that around, to go look at things, to live everywhere we can. It's too dangerous to keep the consciousness of the universe on only one planet. It could be wiped out. And so now we're on two, three if you count the moon. And we can change this one to make it safer to live on. Changing it won't destroy it. Reading its past might get harder, but the beauty of it won't go away. If there are lakes or forests or glaciers, how does that diminish Mars's beauty? I don't think it does. I think it only enhances it. It adds life, the most beautiful system of all, but nothing life can do will bring Tharsis down or fill Marineris. Mars will always remain Mars, different from Earth, colder and wilder. But it can be Mars and ours at the same time. And it will be. There is this about the human mind. If it can be done, it will be done. We can transform Mars and build it like you would build a cathedral, as a monument to humanity and the universe both. We can do it, so we will do it. So, he held up a palm as if satisfied that the analysis had been supported by the data in the graph, as if he had examined the periodic table and found that it still held true. We might as well start. He looked at Anne, and all eyes followed her. Anne's mouth was tight, her shoulders slumped. She knew she was beaten. She shrugged, as if she were shrugging a hooded cape back over her head and body, a heavy carapace that weighed her down, and covered her entirely from them. In the flat, dead tone that she usually employed when she was upset, she said, "I think you value consciousness too high and rock too little. We are not lords of the universe. We're one small part of it. We may be its consciousness, but being the consciousness of the universe does not mean turning it all into a mirror image of us. It means rather fitting into it as it is and worshipping it with our attention." She met Sax's mild gaze, and one final flare of her anger jetted out. "You've never even seen Mars." And she left the room. Janet had had her camera specs on and videotaped this exchange. Phyllis sent a copy back to Earth. A week later, the Yonoma Committee on Environmental Alterations approved the dissemination of the heater windmills. The plan was to drop them from dirigibles. Arcadi immediately claimed the right to pilot one as a sort of reward for his work on Phobos. Maya and Frank were not unhappy at the thought of Arcadi disappearing from Underhill for another month or two, so they immediately assigned him one of the craft. He would drift east in the prevailing winds, descending to place windmills in channel beds and on the outer flanks of craters, both places where winds tended to be strong. Nadia first heard of the expedition when Arcadi skipped through the chambers to her and told her about it. "Sounds nice," she said. "Want to come along?" he asked. "Why, yes," she said. Her ghost finger was tingling. Their dirigible was the biggest ever made, a planetary model built back in Germany by Friedrichshafen nach Einmal and shipped up in 2029 so that it had just recently arrived. It was called the Arrowhead, and it measured 120 meters across the wings, 100 meters front to back, and 40 meters tall. It had an internal ultralight frame and turboprops at each wingtip and under the gondola. These were driven by small plastic engines whose batteries were powered by solar cells arrayed on the upper surface of the bag. The pencil-shaped gondola extended most of the length of the underside, but it was smaller inside than Nadia had expected, because much of it was temporarily filled with their cargo of windmills. At takeoff, their clear space consisted of nothing more than the cockpit, two narrow beds, a tiny kitchen, an even smaller toilet, and the crawl space necessary to move among these. It was pretty tight, but happily both sides of the gondola were walled with windows, and though somewhat blocked by windmills, these still gave them a lot of light and good visibility. Takeoff was slow. Arkady released the lines extending from the three mooring masts with the flip of a cockpit toggle. The turboprops ran hard, but they were dealing with air that was only 12 millibars thick. The cockpit bounced up and down in slow motion, flexing with the internal frame, and every up-bounce was a little higher off the ground. For someone used to rocket launches, it was comical. "Let's take a 360 and see Underhill before we go," Arkady said when they were 50 meters high. He banked the ship, and they made a slow, wide turn, looking out Nadia's window. Tracks, pits, mounds of regolith, all dark red against the dusty orange surface of the plain. It looked as if a dragon had reached down with a great taloned claw and drawn blood time after time. Underhill sat at the center of the wounds, and by itself was a pretty sight. A square, dark red setting for a shiny glass and silver jewel, with green just visible under the dome. Extending away from it were the roads east to Chernobyl and north to the space pads, and over there were the long bulbs of the greenhouses, and there was the trailer park. "The alchemist's quarter still looks like something out of the Urals," Arkady said. "We really have to do something about that." He brought the dirigible out of its turn and headed east, moving with the wind. "Should I run us over Chernobyl and catch the updraft?" "Why don't we see what this thing can do unassisted?" Nadia said. She felt light, as if the hydrogen in the ballonets had filled her as well. The view was stupendous, the hazy horizon perhaps 100 kilometers away, the contours of the land all clearly visible, the subtle bumps and hollows of Luni, the more prominent hills and canyons of the channel terrain to the east. "Oh, this is going to be wonderful."
"Yes."
It was remarkable, in fact, that they hadn't done anything like this before. But flying on Mars was no easy thing because of the thin atmosphere. They were in the best solution. A dirigible as big and light as possible, filled with hydrogen, which in Martian air was not only not flammable, but also even lighter relative to its surroundings than it would have been on Earth. Hydrogen and the latest in superlight materials gave them the lift to carry a cargo like their windmills, but with such a cargo aboard, they were ludicrously sluggish. And so they drifted along. All that day they crossed the rolling plain of Luni Planum, pushed southeast by the wind. For an hour or two they could see Juventa Chasm on the southern horizon, a gash of canyon that looked like a giant pit mine. Farther east the land turned yellowish, there was less surface rubble and the underlying bedrock was more rumpled. There were also many more craters, craters big and small, crisp-rimmed or nearly buried. This was Xanthi Terra, a high region that was topographically similar to the southern uplands, here sticking into the north between the low plains of Chrysi and Isidus. They would be over Xanthi for some days if the prevailing westerlies held true. They were progressing at a leisurely 10 kilometers per hour. Most of the time they flew at an altitude of about 100 meters, which put the horizons about 50 kilometers away. They had time to look closely at anything they wanted to, although Xanthi was proving to be little more than a steady succession of craters. Late that afternoon, Nadia tilted the nose of the dirigible down and circled into the wind, dropping until they were within 10 meters of the ground and then releasing their anchor. The ship rose, jerked on its line, and settled downwind of the anchor, tugging at it like a fat kite. Nadia and Arkady twisted down the length of the gondola to what Arkady called the bomb bay. Nadia lifted a windmill onto the bay's winch hook. The windmill was a little thing, a magnesium box with 4 vertical vanes on a rod projecting from its top. It weighed about 5 kilos. They closed the bay door on it, sucked out the air, and opened the bottom doors. Arkady operated the winch, looking through a low window to see what he was doing. The windmill dropped like a plum and bumped onto hardened sand on the southern flank of a small, unnamed crater. He released the winch hook and reeled it back into the bay and closed the bomb doors. They returned to the cockpit and looked down again to see if the windmill was working. There it stood, a small box on the outside slope of a crater, somewhat tilted, the 4 broad vertical blades spinning merrily. It looked like an anemometer from a kid's meteorology kit. The heating element, an exposed metal coil that would radiate like a stovetop, was on one side of the base. In a good wind, the element might get up to 200 degrees centigrade, which wasn't bad, especially in that ambient temperature. Still, it's going to take a lot of those to make any difference, Nadia remarked. Sure, but every little bit helps, and in a way it's free heat, not only the wind powering the heaters, but the sun powering the factories making the windmills. I think they're a good idea. They stopped once more that afternoon to set out another one, then anchored for the night in the lee of a crisp young crater. They microwaved a meal in the tiny kitchen and then retired to their narrow bunks. It felt odd to rock on the wind, like a boat at its mooring, tug and float, tug and float. It was very relaxing when you got used to it, and soon Nadia was asleep. The next morning they woke before dawn, cast off, and motored up into the sunlight. From 100 meters height, they could watch the shadowed landscape below turn to bronze as the Terminator rolled by and clear daylight followed, illuminating a fantastic jumble of bright rocks and long shadows. The morning wind pushed right to left across their bow, so they were pushed northeast toward Chrysi, humming along with the props on full power. Then the land fell away below them, and they were over the first of the outflow channels they would pass, a sinuous, unnamed valley west of Shalbatana Vallis. This little arroyo's S-shape was unmistakably water-cut. Later that day, they lofted out over the deeper and much wider canyon of Shalbatana, and the signs were even more obvious. Tear-shaped islands, curving channels, alluvial plains, scablands. There were signs everywhere of a massive flood, a flood that had created a canyon so huge that the arrowhead suddenly looked like a butterfly. The outflow canyons and the high land between them reminded Nadia of the landscape of American cowboy movies, with washes and mesas and isolated ship rocks, as in Monument Valley. Except here it lasted for 4 days as they passed in succession over the unnamed channel, Shalbatana, Simud, Tiu, and then Ares. And all of them had been caused by giant floods which had burst onto the surface and flowed for months at rates 10,000 times that of the Mississippi. Nadia and Arkady talked about that as they looked down into the canyons under them, but it was very hard to imagine floods so huge. Now the big empty canyons funneled nothing but wind. They did that quite well, however, so Arkady and Nadia descended into them a number of times per day to drop more windmills. Then, east of Ares Vallis, they floated back over the densely crated terrain of Xanthi. Again, the land was everywhere marred by craters, big craters, little craters, old craters, new craters, craters with rims marred by newer craters, craters with floors punctured by 3 or 5 smaller craters, craters as fresh as if they had been struck yesterday, craters that just barely showed at dawn and dusk as buried arcs in the old plateau. They passed over Schiaparelli, a giant old crater 100 kilometers across, When they floated over its central uplift knob, its crater walls formed their horizon, a perfect ring of hills around the edge of the world. After that, winds blew from the south for several days. They caught a glimpse of Cassini, another great old crater, and passed over hundreds of smaller ones. They dropped several windmills per day, but the flight was giving them a stronger sense of the size of the planet, and the project began to seem like a joke, as if they flew over Antarctica and tried to melt the ice by setting down a number of camping stoves. "You'd have to drop millions to make any difference," Nadia said as they climbed up from another drop. "True," Arkady said. "But Sax would like to drop millions. He's got an automated assembly line that will just keep churning them out. It's only distribution that's a problem. And besides, it's just one part of the campaign he has in mind." He gestured back toward the last arc of Cassini, inscribing the whole northwest. "Sax would like to bang out a few more holes like that one, capture some icy moonlets from Saturn or from the asteroid belt if he can find any, and push them back and smash them into Mars, make hot craters, melt the permafrost. They'd be like oases."
"Dry oases, wouldn't they be?"
"You'd lose most of the ice on entry and have the rest disappear on contact."
"Sure, but we can use more water vapor in the air."
"But it wouldn't just vaporize, it would break into its constituent atoms."
"Some of it. But hydrogen and oxygen, we could use more of both."
"So you're bringing hydrogen and oxygen from Saturn? Come on, there's lots of both here already. You could just break down some of the ice."
"Well, it's just one of his ideas."
"I can't wait to hear what Anne says to that." She sighed, thought about it. "The thing to do, I suppose, would be to graze an ice asteroid through the atmosphere, as if trying to aerobrake it. That would burn it up without breaking the molecules apart. You'd get water vapor in the atmosphere, which would help, but you wouldn't be bombing the surface with explosions as big as 100 hydrogen bombs going off all at once."
Arkady nodded. "Good idea. You should tell Sax."
"You tell him." East of Cassini, the terrain grew rougher than ever. This was some of the oldest surface on the planet, cratered to saturation in the earliest years of torrential bombardment. A hellish age, the Noachian. You could see that in the landscape. A no-man's land from a titanic trench war. The sight of it induced a kind of numbness after a while, a cosmological shell shock. They floated on, east, northeast, southeast, south, northeast, west, east, east. They finally came to the end of Xanthi and began to descend the long slope of Syrtis Major Planitia. This was a lava plain, much less densely cratered than Xanthi. The land sloped down and down until finally they drifted over a smooth-floored basin, Isidis Planitia, one of the lowest points on Mars. It was the essence of the northern hemisphere, and after the southern highlands it seemed especially smooth and flat and low. And it, too, was a very large region. There really was a lot of land on Mars. Then one morning, when they lofted up to cruising altitude, a trio of peaks rose over the eastern horizon. They had come to Elysium, the only other Tharsis-like bulge continent that the planet had. Elysium was a much smaller bulge than Tharsis, but it was still big. A high continent, 1,000 kilometers long and 10 kilometers taller than the surrounding terrain. As with Tharsis, it was ringed by patches of fractured land, crack systems caused by the uplift. They flew over the westernmost of these crack systems, Hephaestus Fossae, and found the area an unearthly sight. 5 long, deep, parallel canyons, like claw marks in the bedrock. Elysium loomed beyond, a saddleback in shape, Elysium Mons and Hecate's Tholus, rearing at each end of a long spine range, 5,000 meters higher than the bulge they punctuated, an awesome sight. Everything about Elysium was so much bigger than anything Nadia and Arkady had seen so far that as the dirigible floated toward the range, the two were speechless for minutes at a time. They sat in their seats, watching it all float slowly toward them. When they did speak, it was just thinking aloud. "Looks like the Karakoram," Arkady said. Desert Himalayas. Except these are so simple. Those volcanoes look like Fuji. Maybe people will hike up them someday in pilgrimages. Nadia said, "These are so big, it's hard to imagine what the Tharsis volcanoes will look like. Aren't the Tharsis volcanoes twice as big as these?" "At least, it does look like Fuji, don't you think?" "No, it's a lot less steep. Why, did you ever see Fuji?"
"No."
After a while, "Well, we'd better try to go around the whole damn thing," Arkady said. "I'm not sure we have the loft to get over those mountains." So they turned the props and pushed south as hard as they could, and the winds naturally cooperated as they were curving around the continent, too. So the Arrowhead floated southeast into a rough mountainous region called Cerberus, and all of the next day they could mark their progress by the side of Elysium, passing slowly to their left. Hours passed, the massif shifted in their side windows. The slowness of the shift made it plain just how big this world was. "Mars has as much land surface as the Earth." Everyone always said that, but it had been just a phrase. Their creep around Elysium was the proof of the senses. The days passed, up in the frigid morning air, over the jumbled red land, down in the sunset, to bounce at an airy anchorage. One evening, when the supply of windmills had dwindled, they rearranged those that remained and moved their beds together under the starboard windows. They did it without discussion, as if it had been the obvious thing to do when they had room, as if they had already agreed to do it long before. And as they moved around the cramped gondola rearranging things, they bumped into each other just as they had all trip long, but now intentionally, and with a sensuous rubbing which accentuated what they had been up to all along. Accidents become foreplay. And finally Arkady burst out laughing and caught her up in a wild bear hug, and Nadia shouldered him back onto their new double bed, and they kissed like teenagers and made love through the night. And after that, they slept together, and made love frequently in the ruddy glow of dawn and in the starry black nights, with the ship lightly bobbing at its moorings. And they lay together talking, and the sensation of floating as they embraced was palpable, more romantic than any train or ship. "We became friends first," Arkady said once. "That's what makes this different, don't you think?" He prodded her with a finger. "I love you." It was as if he were testing the words with his tongue. It was clear to Nadia that he hadn't said them often. It was clear they meant a lot to him, a kind of commitment. Ideas meant so much to him. "And I love you," she said. And in the mornings Arkady would pad up and down the narrow gondola naked, his red hair bronzed like everything else by the horizontal morning light, and Nadia would watch from their bed, feeling so serene and happy that she had to remind herself that the floating sensation was probably just Martian G, but it felt like joy. One night as they were falling asleep, Nadia said curiously, "Why me?"
"Huh?"
He had been almost asleep. "I said, why me? I mean, Arkady Nikolaevich, you could have loved any of the women here, and they would have loved you back. You could have had Maya if you wanted." He snorted.
"I could have had Maya. Oh, my! I could have had the joy of Maya Katerina. Just like Frank and John."
He snorted, and they both laughed out loud.
"How could I have passed on such joy? Silly me!"
He giggled until she punched him. "All right, all right. One of the others, then, the beautiful ones, Janet or Ursula or Samantha." "Come on," he said. He propped himself up on an elbow to look at her. "You really don't know what beauty is, do you?"
"I certainly do," Nadia said mulishly.
Arkady ignored her and said, "Beauty is power and elegance, right action, form-fitting function, intelligence and reasonability. And very often,
He grinned and pushed at her belly. Expressed in curves.
Curves I've got, Nadia said, pushing his hand away. He leaned forward and tried to bite her breast, but she dodged him.
Beauty is what you are, Nadezhda Francine. By these criteria, you are Queen of Mars.
Princess of Mars, she corrected absently, thinking it over.
Yes, that's right. Nadezhda Francine Chernyshevsky, the Nine-Fingered Princess of Mars.
You're not a conventional man.
No, he hooted. I never claimed to be, except before certain selection committees, of course. A conventional man. The conventional men get Maya. That is their reward. And he laughed like a wild man.
One morning they crossed the last broken hills of Cerberus and floated out over the flat, dusty plain of Amazonas Planitia. Arkady brought the dirigible down to set a windmill in a pass between two final hillocks of old Cerberus. Something went wrong with the clasp on the winch hook, however, and it snapped open when the windmill was only halfway to the ground. The windmill thumped down flat on its base. From the ship it looked okay, but when Nadia suited up and descended in the sling to check it out, she found that the hot plate had cracked away from the base. And there, behind the plate, was a mass of something. A dull green something with a touch of blue to it, dark inside the box. She reached in with a screwdriver and poked at it carefully.
Shit, she said.
What? Arkady said above. She ignored him and scraped some of the substance into a bag she used for screws and nuts. She got into the sling.
Pull me back up, she ordered.
What's wrong? Arkady asked.
Just get me up there.
He closed the bomb bay doors after her and met her as she was getting out of the sling.
What's up?
She took off her helmet.
You know what's up, you bastard.
She took a swing at him, and he leaped back, banging into a wall of windmills.
Ow!
He cried. A vein had caught him in the back.
Hey, what's the problem, Nadia?
She took the bag from her walker pocket and waved it before him.
This is the problem. How could you do it? How could you lie to me? You bastard, do you have any idea what kind of trouble this is going to get us in? They'll come up here and send us all back to Earth.
Round-eyed, Arkady rubbed his jaw.
I wouldn't lie to you, Nadia, he said earnestly. I don't lie to my friends. Let me see that.
She stared at him, and he stared back, his arms stretched out for the bag, the whites of his eyes visible all the way round the irises. He shrugged, and she frowned.
You really don't know? She demanded.
Know what? She couldn't believe he would fake ignorance. It just wasn't his style, which suddenly made things very strange.
At least some of our windmills are little algae farms.
What?
The fucking windmills that we've been dropping everywhere, she said. They're stuffed with Vlad's new algae or lichen or whatever it is. Look.
She put the little bag on the tiny kitchen table, opened it, and used the screwdriver to spoon out a little bit of it.
Little knobby chunks of bluish lichen, like Martian life forms out of an old pulp novel.
They stared at it.
Well, I'll be damned, Arkady said.
He leaned over until his eyes were a centimeter from the stuff on the table.
You swear you didn't know? Nadia demanded.
I swear. I wouldn't do that to you, Nadia. You know that. She heaved a big breath.
Well, our friends would do it to us, apparently.
He straightened up and nodded.
That's right.
He was distracted, thinking hard. He went to one of the windmill bases and hefted it away from the others.
Where was it?
Behind the heating pad.
They went to work on it with Nadia's tools and got it open. Behind the plate was another colony of underhill algae.
Nadia poked around at the edges of the plate and discovered a pair of small hinges where the top of the plate met the inside of the container wall.
Look, it's made to open.
But who opens it? Arkady said.
Radio?
Well, I'll be damned.
Arkady stood, walked up and down the narrow corridor. I mean, how many dirigible trips have been made so far? 10? 20? And all of them dropping these things?
Arkady started to laugh.
He tilted his head back, and his huge, crazed grin split his red beard in two, and he laughed until he held his sides. Nadia, who didn't think it was funny at all, nevertheless felt her face grinning at the sight of him. "It's not funny," she protested. "We're in big trouble."
"Maybe," he said.
"Definitely. And it's all your fault. Some of those fool biologists in the trailer park took your anarchist rant seriously."
"Well," he said, "that at least is a point in their favor, the bastards. I mean..."
He went back to the kitchen table to stare at the clump of blue stuff.
"Who exactly do you think we're talking about, anyway? How many of our friends are in on this, and why in the world didn't they tell me?"
This really rankled, she could tell. In fact, the more he thought about it, the less amused he was, because the algae meant there was a subculture in their group that was acting outside Unoma supervision, but had not let Arkady in on it, even though he had been the first and most vocal advocate of such subversion. What did that mean? Were there people who were on his side but didn't trust him? Were there dissidents with a competing program? They had no way of telling. Eventually, they pulled anchor and sailed on over Amazonas. They passed a medium-sized crater named Pettit, and Arkady remarked that it would make a good site for a windmill, but Nadia only snarled. They flew by, talking the situation over. Certainly, several people in the bioengineering labs had to be in on it. Probably most of them, maybe all. And then Sachs, the designer of the windmills, certainly had to be a part of it. And Hiroko had been an advocate of the windmills, but they had neither been sure why. It was impossible to judge whether she would approve of something like this or not, as she was simply too close with her opinions. But it was possible. As they talked it over, they took the broken windmill completely apart. The heating plate doubled as a gate for the compartment containing the algae. When the gate opened, the algae would be released into an area that would be a bit warmer because of the hot plate itself. Each windmill thus functioned as a micro-oasis, and if the algae managed to survive with its help, and then grow beyond the small area warmed by the hot plate, then good. If not, it was not going to do very well on Mars anyway. The hot plate served to give it a good send-off, nothing more. Or so its designers must have thought. "We've been made into Johnny Appleseed," Arkady said.
"Johnny what?"
"American folktale." He told her about it. "Yeah, right. And now Paul Bunyan is going to come kick our ass."
"Ha, never. Big Man is much bigger than Paul Bunyan, believe me."
"Big Man?"
"You know, all those names for landscape features. Big Man's footprints, Big Man's bathtub, Big Man's golf course, whatever."
"Ah, yeah.
Anyway, I don't see why we should get in trouble. We didn't know anything about it."
"Now who's going to believe that?"
"Good point. Those bastards, they really got me with this one."
Clearly, this was what bothered Arkady most. Not that they had contaminated Mars with alien biota, but that he had been kept out of a secret. Men were such egomaniacs when it came down to it. And Arkady, he had his own group of friends, perhaps more than that, people who agreed with him, followers of a sort. The whole Phobos crew, a lot of the programmers in Underhill, and if some of his own people were keeping things from him, that was bad. But if another group had secret plans of its own, that was worse, apparently, because they were at least interference and perhaps competition. Or so he seemed to think. He wouldn't say much of this explicitly, but it became obvious in his mutterings and his sudden sharp curses, which were genuine, even though they alternated with bursts of hilarity. He couldn't seem to make up his mind whether he was pleased or angry, and Nadia finally believed that he was both at once. That was Arkady. He felt things freely and to the full, and wasn't much worried about consistency. But she wasn't too sure she liked his reasons this time, for either his anger or his amusement, and she told him so with considerable irritation.
"Well, but come on," he cried. "Why should they keep it a secret from me when it was my idea to begin with?"
"Because they knew I might come along with you. If they told you, you would have had to tell me. And if you told me, I would have stopped it."
Arkady laughed outrageously at this. "So it was pretty considerate of them after all. Fuck."
The bioengineers, Sachs, the people in the quarter who had actually constructed the things, someone in communications probably. There were quite a few who must have known.
"What about Hiroko?" Arkady asked.
They couldn't decide. They didn't know enough of her views to be able to guess what she might think. Nadia was pretty sure she was in on it, but couldn't explain why. "I suppose," she said, thinking about it, "I suppose I feel like there is this group around Hiroko, the whole farm team and a fair number of others who respect her and follow her. Even Anne, in a way. Although Anne will hate this when she hears about it. Whew! Anyway, it just seems to me that Hiroko would know about anything secret going on, especially something having to do with ecological systems. The bioengineering group works with her most of the time, after all, and for some of them she's like a guru. They almost worship her. They probably got her advice when they were splicing this algae together." So they probably got her agreement for the idea. Maybe I should even say her permission.
Arkady nodded. "I see your point."
On and on they talked, hashing over every point of it. The land they passed over, flat and immobile, looked different to Nadia now. It was seeded, fertilized. It was going to change now, inevitably. They talked about the other parts of Sachs's terraforming plans, giant orbiting mirrors reflecting sunlight onto the dawn and dusk terminators, carbon distributed over the polar caps, aerothermal heat, the ice asteroids. It was all really going to happen, it seemed. The debate had been bypassed. They were going to change the face of Mars. The second evening after their momentous discovery, as they were cooking dinner in a crater's lee anchorage, they got a call from Underhill, relayed off one of the comm satellites.
"Hey, you two," John Boone said by way of greeting. "We've got a problem."
"You've got a problem," Nadia replied.
"Why, something wrong out there?"
"No, no."
"Well, good. Because really it's you guys who have the problem, and I wouldn't want you to have more than one. A dust storm has started down in the Claritas Fossi region, and it's growing and coming north at a good rate. We think it'll reach you in a day or so."
"Isn't it early for dust storms?" Arkady asked.
"Well, no, we're at LS-240, which is pretty much the usual season for it, southern spring. Anyway, there it is, and it's coming your way."
He sent a satellite photo of the storm, and they studied their TV screen closely. The region south of Tharsis was now obscured by an amorphous yellow cloud.
"We'd better take off for home right now," Nadia said after studying the photo.
"At night?"
"We can run the props on batteries tonight, and recharge the batteries tomorrow morning. After that, we may not have much sunlight unless we can get above the dust."